From the Sky News Centre at 6, Downing Street Communications Chief Andy Coulson has quit after admitting the News of the World phone hacking row was making his job impossible. He says the drip-drip of claims about illegal eavesdropping under his editorship meant he could not give the 110% needed. Critics insist the resignation is long overdue. Labour leader Ed Miliband agrees.
He's now done the right thing, but he should have done it earlier. And I think it raises real questions about David Cameron's judgment that he hung on to Andy Coulson for as long as he did.
Police have until late tomorrow evening to keep questioning Joanna Yates's neighbour in Bristol. 32-year-old Vincent Tabak was arrested yesterday morning on suspicion of murdering her. Tony Blair's been shouted down as he expressed regret for the loss of life in the Iraq War. The former Prime Minister told the official inquiry into the conflict he regrets deeply and profoundly the deaths of British troops and Iraqi civilians. Members of the audience jeered at his comments, shouting it's too late. One of them was Sarah Chapman, whose brother Sergeant Bob O'Connor was killed in 2005.
As he got up and went, I then turned around and I shouted at him because he was so disrespectful to the families that I turned around and said that you lied and our loved ones died.
A judge has approved the extradition of an alleged terror suspect to the United States. Prosecutors claim Abid Nazir was a member of an Al-Qaeda cell in the UK. Authorities in the US want him to stand trial over an alleged bomb plot in New York. The case will now go before the Home Secretary. It's been announced that British Airways cabin crew have voted in favour of fresh strikes. Members of Unite were balloted following a long-running dispute over pay. About 400 people attended the funeral mass of singer-songwriter Jerry Rafferty in Paisley today. He died after a long illness early this month at the age of 63. The star was best known for the hits Baker Street and Stuck in the Middle with You. That's the latest. I'm Rachel Jewell.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Welcome back to Friday Drive Time with old Labour economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Coming up, we take a look at the murky world of the European Union. Do our MEPs have any power? And why is there so little discussion about the rights and wrongs of the EU? We'll be talking to one of the UK's most vehement Eurosceptics. But first, I'm joined by Mike Birkin from Bristol and South West Friends of the Earth. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Tony.
Now, ministers are being urged to halt controversial projects to drill for shale gas over fears that it poses significant risk to public health and the environment. A new report prepared for the Co-op has warned that the full impact of drilling for shale gas, which is an energy resource that has sparked a frenzy of exploration in the United States, should be assessed before the go-ahead is given to projects in the UK. The warning comes as the mining company Quadrillo, which sounds like it should be spelt with a Q, but it's not, it's with a C, Quadrillo Resources, prepares to begin more drilling at a find near Blackpool, Lancashire, which it says is the first true shale gas find in Europe. Quadrillo, which includes former BP chief and Whitehall non-executive director Lord Brown of Brown Report, that was to do with the Higher Education Review fame, on its board, said preliminary drilling confirmed and possibly exceeded its expectations. Quadrillo is planning more extensive drilling later this month, which could involve a controversial technique needed in shale gas extraction called fracking. That's F-R-A-C-K-I-N-G. When the rock is fractured using chemicals. The demand to halt shale gas drilling comes amid rising concerns about the chemicals used in fracking, causing groundwater contamination, and which has led to a temporary ban imposed on a New York state. A new film, Gaslands, which includes clips of homeowners turning on their taps and igniting gas in areas where shale reserves are being extracted, has heightened campaigners' concerns. Now, Mike, this is almost sounds like some sort of rather bad comedy. What is going on here? Pouring chemicals into the ground in order to get gas to then be released from the rocks?
Yeah, I'm afraid it isn't comedy. It's something that the industry is quite serious about doing. They obviously want to go ahead with it. We completely agree with the sentiments expressed in this report that was commissioned by the co-op, really. It's nonsensical to do such a high-risk operation until you really understand what it is that the consequences could be. And, yeah, we know from recent history that the record of the oil and gas exploration industry is that if things can go wrong, sooner or later they will. So it's a high-risk operation. And ultimately, you've got to look at it in the long-term perspective and say, well, not even the long term, really, over the next 20 years, we need to be completely changing our energy economy, getting away from the fossil carbon-based sources as fast as we can. So what's the point of investing huge new amounts of money and kit in getting more gas out of the ground?
So, but you know how these things work. I mean, if there's money around, or the banks seem to have money for these kind of projects, and the companies are willing to do it, then the government, there tends to be very, very slack regulation, doesn't there? And they just sort of seem to get on with it.
Yeah, that's, well, the government's very, very happy to take a completely market-driven approach to our energy, future energy supplies and energy security, and we think they should be given a much stronger steer to banks and investors and saying, you know, what they're going to be putting the money in now is major development in offshore renewables. We just had our regional meeting at the weekend down in Plymouth. We had a very good speaker from Regen Southwest, which is the Southwest Renewable Energy Agency, explaining what the potential was for the economy of we were down in Plymouth, and saying what the economy of that area could be benefiting so much from major development of offshore renewable energy, wind, marine currents, tidal and wave power. But Britain was in danger of again losing the race. Investors were looking elsewhere. They were looking to Spain. England is losing out to Scotland. The Scottish government takes a much more proactive attitude towards renewables on land and on sea, and the industry is putting its money up there. It's not putting it down in the West Coast country in Devon and Cornwall and the Bristol Channel.
Martin, what about the economics of this? Because clearly, if Lord Brown thinks he's going to be able to make a few bob with Quadrilla, getting this gas out of the ground by pouring chemicals into it, surely he's just going to carry on and do that, isn't he?
Well, all this revolves around the oil price, doesn't it, really? I mean, you only do things like this if the oil price makes it viable. And of course, the oil price, like many other commodity prices, is being affected by speculative flows from the financial sector. So it's not just to do with the long run supply and demand of oil. We've also got bubbles developing in all the commodities as a result of the financial mess that we're in. And this gives a completely distorted price, which then makes things like this look as if they're viable. But if we had a more rational pricing system in the financial markets, which priced commodities over the long run rather than on the basis of speculation, then possibly a lot of this stuff wouldn't look viable at all.
Mike, do you think there's any prospect of sort of raising environmental objections and getting this stopped?
That prospect has been given a powerful boost by the decision of the co-op bank to, you know, the co-op group, I should say, it's not just the co-op bank, the co-op group, to launch this report and to call on investors not to put their money into the shale sands.
So why has the co-op decided to take this up as a cause? I mean, you think of the co-op as just a sort of supermarket like Sainsbury's or Tesco's, or, you know, you don't think of that they're the first people to step out to save the environment necessarily.
Well, we've worked quite closely with the co-op over a number of issues recently. I mean, they are shareholder-owned. I mean, it's owned by its members. They do have quite a strong ethical property policy.
Because if you've got a Tesco club card, you don't own Tesco's, do you?
No, you don't get any vote as to who the director of Tesco's is. But the co-op, you do. So, you know, it's a big company. It's got its flaws, but it's in terms of the ethical choices that you might have to make as to which supermarket you go to or which of the big institutions you trust, I'd say the co-op was quite a significant way ahead of a lot of the competition.
Now, Martin, Lord Brown, who's fronting this Quadrilla company, he's also one of these sort of Bilderbergers, which is the 150 or so of some of the richest, most powerful people from the oil business, the European Central Bank, the US Federal Reserve, also royalty. I mean, do you think, am I being too much of a conspiracy theorist here, thinking that actually Ed Balls, who's the new Shadow Chancellor, is there something wrong with people like Lord Brown sitting down in a secret conference with Ed Balls and George Osborne?
I think the issue about Bilderberg, if that's what we're talking about, is basically people are entitled to have private meetings amongst themselves if that's what they want to do. It's very hard to stop that. But what is questionable is elected officials going along to these meetings and not telling people that they're there. If people, somebody like Ed Balls is an elected official, if he goes to Bilderberg, I want to know about it. But for example, Tony Blair denied that he was going to Bilderberg, and it came out that he was. And that, I think, is very questionable if people are going to these meetings in secret when they are our elected representatives.
Oh, one of the things that when they do go along, these elected representatives, is they're not allowed to say anything about what has happened within. Do you think that's okay for an elected official to do that?
I don't think elected officials should go to Bilderberg at all.
In fact, in the United States, apparently, there are laws that stop elected officials going to these private meetings without declaring everything that's happened at them. Mm. I think this is essentially the problem here, is that it's okay for the business people to be meeting up, but when an senior elected official, whether it's a prime minister, anybody really, is going to a meeting like this and simply not declaring it, that there really is a problem there as to where their loyalties lie.
We've seen this in the Chilcot inquiry, where Tony Blair is saying that his discussions with Bush are private discussions and we're not allowed to know what was said in those discussions. Now, I would say that when Tony Blair was having those discussions, he was our employee and he was working in our time. And I want to know what he said to Mr. Bush. I don't think it's his private, that's public information. And if you're going to run any big organisation, there's got to be an element of confidentiality. But there's also got to be accountability.
One of the other things, of course, that's come out in Chilcot is that the Attorney General, well, it's not just come out through Chilcot, but the Attorney General has been someone traditionally who's been an MP, who's been an elected member. And one of the things that changes that Tony Blair brought in was to sort of get anybody, basically any lawyer, and make them into a lord, sort of click his fingers and overnight, and then get them in to be Attorney General. Do you think there's a problem with that? And that was one of the problems with the Iraq War or not. Is that okay to do that?
Well, I mean, Lord Goldsmith was Tony Blair's personal friend, so you could say this is extremely kind of incestuous. But nevertheless, it seems that he was advising Tony Blair that the war was illegal. But Blair was telling everybody that he didn't have any such advice. I think that's going to trip him up.
Sorry, well, we are actually talking about the environment. We've got off the topic a little bit.
Well, everything's connected to everything else.
And I know you've got some meetings coming up, Mike. Can you tell us about the Cycling City?
Yeah, sure. We've got a series of three public meetings coming up. They're first Tuesday of the month at the YHA down by the harbour. And the first one is basically Bristol, a couple of years ago, won this award from the old government to be the UK's first cycling city. It got quite a lot of money to promote cycling around the city. That money's now coming to an end, and really it's a discussion amongst some of the key players, including, I believe, John Rogers, who was on your show just now, to discuss, you know, what we want to do next and how we want to capitalise on whatever benefits we might have gained from having been Cycling City. Does it all just stop? Are we going to stop promoting cycling or fall off our bicycles and pretend that didn't happen? I think not. No, we want to think about how we can develop. There's been a really good growth in cycling in Bristol over the past couple of years, and what does that mean? How can we capitalise on that?
So the big problem, of course, is that cars and bicycles don't mix very well, do they? And I wonder if you think that we've really made a lot of changes, and it's been successful in Bristol in actually creating some cycle routes in and out of the city centre.
Yeah, I think what Cycling City's done, in my view, has been a little bit marginal, and it hasn't, as you point out, the central problem is being able to get around the city without having to kind of take your chances with the traffic. I mean, I just cycle down Eastern Way to get here, and it's not very nice, but I'm a pretty confident cyclist. I think a lot of people will be put off by having to do that. So until you've got a really good network of off-road cycle routes, and until you've tamed the traffic down so that in areas where you do have no choice other than to mingle with the traffic, it's the cyclists and the pedestrians that get the priority. If we can create our city centre spaces to be like that, then that, I think, would do even more to reduce car traffic and encourage cycling.
Well, it's not the right time of year, really, to try to be persuading people to get on their bikes, is it, and out of their cars. It's just not a very nice time of year to be cycling. It's too cold. And also, I mean, obviously, we had all the ice and stuff before Christmas. What would you say to try and persuade anyone that there actually is a realistic prospect if they've got a reasonably short car journey to actually get on the bike instead?
Well, I'd say that the number of people cycling in Bristol has grown quite markedly over the past couple of years. I don't think that is necessarily a cause and effect because we've been cycling city. I think there's been quite a few other factors as well to do with just the expense of getting around by bus or by car. In fact, it's becoming increasingly inconvenient to do so. So a lot of people are taking to the bike and finding that it's actually enjoyable. And I don't think you need to worry about cold weather. You need a pair of gloves so your hands don't get cold, but basically you're working physically when you're on a bike. Cold weather doesn't really bother you. So I think, you know, if people need encouragement and boosting their confidence to get out and try it, they need to feel they're going to be reasonably protected from the traffic. But in terms of actually physically being able to do it, that's not the problem.
Is there going to be any way of getting people off these gym bicycles, you know, and getting them onto real bicycles?
Yeah, it would be great, wouldn't it? I mean, it's the whole thing about cycling in the real world as opposed to in a gym is, you know, it makes your senses more alert. You notice what's around you very much more. I feel I really benefit from my, you know, 10 minutes cycle ride into the office in the morning. I'm awake when I get there. I wasn't when I left the house.
You've got another meeting coming up on localism, haven't you?
Yeah, that's right. The government's new localism and decentralisation bill came into Parliament at the start of the week. It's a very curious kind of bill because there's a lot of good talk in there about handing power back to communities, but we're really worried about the reality of what happens if when the government kind of lets loose on the planning system. Does that necessarily hand power back to the communities, or does it actually give it to the big corporate vested interests who've got a lot less organised and powerful opposition to rein in what they might want to do?
So, but for most of us, the planning system is not only very difficult to understand, it's also very, very dull. And obviously, it's not quite so dull when you're making lots and lots of money from getting planning permission.
I may be a bit of a sad individual. I don't think the planning system's dull at all.
No?
It's about the kind of place that we want to live in the future, and surely all of us have got an interest in that. It's just a bit hard to see when you're talking to a bureaucrat or wading through a very, very unfriendly document how that really does relate to the kind of place that you want to live in. But actually, it's real bread and butter of the kind of places we want to live in. So it's deeply fascinating. But I can understand why people feel put off by the system. It's not designed to draw people in or be even-handed or user-friendly. The localism bill may have some good spin-offs. It may encourage people to get involved in planning their future, their neighbourhoods, because they actually have some power to do something to make it real. But as I say, for a lot of communities, the danger is not that it puts power in their hands, it actually allows much bigger interests free rein over them.
Martin, sounds great, doesn't it, localism?
Yeah, well, I mean, as we were talking with John Rogers earlier, the problem with localism is it can just end up being, as has been pointed out, dominated by vested interests. And you do actually have to have some kind of a plan, some kind of central plan. I mean, I know it's not very popular to say this, and we've had a whole generation of people saying, oh, we don't need a plan, we just leave it to the market, we need to decentralise. Actually, you do need a plan, you do. And it's actually something quite positive, because then you've got a vision of what you get, where you're going. For example, in terms of energy, you're not just leaving it to some kind of random selection of committees which are going to make contradictory decisions.
But I didn't have you down as a Stalinist, Martin.
No, I'm not a Stalinist, but I think in actual fact I would like to make the case for the way that Britain was run from 1945 until the mid-1970s. Having a plan was not a bad idea at all. Throughout that period, economic growth was 3% per year on average. Since we gave up having a plan, economic growth in Britain has been 1.5% on average. So the free market philosophy is half as efficient as having a central plan. Now, of course, central planning can go wrong, but I don't think that the Royal Mail was being run like Gosplan. I don't think that the British nationalised industries are comparable with what went on in the Soviet Union and other places. And look at China today. They've got a plan, haven't they?
I completely agree with you, Martin, about the virtues of the planning system as we had it from the kind of 1940s onwards. I mean, it was a radical step, and I think politically, you know, we should be cherishing what was done by that government and saying, they were saying that there is a wider community interest in what happens in land, and it's not just down to a developer to say, I can make some money out of this, therefore I will do it, but the broader interest has to be taken into account, and that's what's under threat here.
Well, one of the big problems, of course, is that when it comes to planning decisions made by our city council here, by planning committees, I think we've got three or so, that when a decision is made, although the developer has a right to appeal that decision, the local people don't.
Yes, that's right. And it was one of the things that in the run-up to the general election, the parties that now make the government had promised that they would look into that and bring forward what they call the third-party right of appeal. Exactly as you say, the people who feel they've been adversely affected by a planning decision can appeal. It's not only the developer. That has now been dropped. So the localism bill... Does not rise.
Well, I mean, maybe.
Shocked.
So that's not in this localism bill. So the decision is still going to be appealable by somebody in an office in some other part of the world, but not by the people that have to actually live with the whatever the development is.
Yeah, there's no intention to interfere with that part of the planning system.
That's pretty naughty. That's pretty shocking. Martin, what are we going to do about this?
Well, I mean, the planning system as a whole, we've inherited, is very much in favour of private interests and the developer, which is why they can appeal and local communities can't.
I mean, we don't have court cases where only one side can appeal, say a civil court
case,
do we?
Well, I mean, everything is rigged in favour. I mean, basically, this is a capitalist society where capitalists basically get a free run, unless there's a very good reason for them not to have a free run. So, for example, many people object to planning applications, and they don't realise that local authorities have got very limited powers to block things they don't like. I mean, I think that local authorities ought to have virtually complete control over what goes on in their area, but they don't have it. And people imagine that they do, so they look to the council to say, well, we don't want this development here, can't we stop it? And the answer from the council is often, well, no, we can't stop it. Yeah? And I think that would give local authorities a great deal more, people would take a great deal more interest in them if they really did have the power to decide whether X or Y was going to happen. But they don't, and they never have.
Yeah, which brings me on to the case of the biofuels plant and proposal at Avonmouth for a power station burning imported liquid biofuel, extremely destructive.
Yeah. How's all that going?
Well, to the backstory is that, you know, Bristol City Council courageously turned down that application back last spring. The developer appealed. There was a planning appeal. It was pretty. It was run in a way that was not at all sympathetic to Bristol City Council's stance that the planning inspector refused to hear evidence on whether on damage caused by growing biofuel plantations overseas. Communities Minister, Eric Pickles, has asked for more evidence from the objectors, and a decision is now due very shortly.
Okay, the third of your three meetings you're talking about tonight is this Bristol Green Capital. Are we the Green Capital?
No, we're not, but we aspire to be. Green Capital is a European award, and a number of cities are entitled to enter for it, but each year only one city wins. Bristol has entered for it for a couple of years, but we've never been the winner. And there is a proposal that we should keep trying, we should enter again, and that winning the Green Capital Award would be not only a feather in Bristol's cap, you know, but would actually make a difference. It would make us a greener city. What we have to do to win the award would make us a greener city, so it's really worth putting our effort into it now.
So what would it actually mean if we do?
That's the proposal that we're going to debate at our meeting in March. It'll be the 1st of March, first Tuesday in March, and we've got Alistair Sauday, who's the chair of Bristol's Green Capital Group. He's going to put the proposition that winning the Green Capital Award would really mean something, would make us a much greener city. And people can come along and challenge that, basically. We are actually members of Bristol's Green Capital Group. We see a little bit from the inside where that group is heading, what it's trying to achieve. But there is a genuine question to be asked about, what does it mean anything to win the Green Capital Award? After all, you can win the Eurovision Song Contest without having a great deal of musical talent. So could you win the Green Capital Award without being green?
Okay, these three meetings, the Cycling City, the Localism meeting and the Bristol Green Capital, whereabouts and when
they're
are they?
They're all the first Tuesday of the month, and they start at 7:30, and they are in the YHA building down by the Harbourside.
More generally, whereabouts do we find Friends of the Earth in Bristol and on the internet?
Well, you find us there at those public meetings, and then you find us at bristolfo.org on the internet.
Mike Birkin from Southwest Friends of the Earth, thanks very much. Well, we'll be delving into the murky world of the EU and asking, do MEPs have any power after this? The Edwin Hawkins Singers there with Oh Happy Day. Now, the European Union is an enigma, particularly, it seems, for the Conservative Party. The Lib Dems are generally for it, as is the Labour Party, but the Conservatives are deeply split. As a result, there's little debate because that would open up deep divisions in the Tory party. Many Conservatives over the years have left the party for Nigel Farage and his UKIPs, who are now the strongest showing single party when we have European elections. But still, they may maintain that though we elect MEPs, they have virtually no real power. So, to thrash out some of the facts behind the EU confusion, I've been talking to a retired businessman, former Conservative, now UKIP supporter and passionate Eurosceptic, Idris Francis. And Martin Summers will be listening along, and I'll be asking Martin for his views after we've heard the Eurosceptic position.
I'm Idris Francis. And having voted yes in 1975, I suddenly woke up in 1992, at the time of Maastricht, to realise what the EU really was. It wasn't a free trade area. It's a political takeover of the continent by people we have never elected and we can't remove. It is a wholly corrupt, dishonest, devious, totalitarian organisation, the like of which we have fought against for hundreds of years. And I, for one, I'm not prepared to put up with it. I qualified, graduated as an electronic engineer just over 50 years ago, but it's primarily mathematical. So I'd only worked for anybody else for 2.5 years before I set up my own company, and I sold out in 1994 to retire to become a full-time nuisance to people who tell lies. My father was a solicitor, so I grew up with a better-than-average understanding of fundamental principles like habeas corpus, jury trial, the Constitution, why things are the way they are. And I remember when I said to my father when I was quite young, I don't understand this law, why is this law like this? And my father said, and looking back, I know that he was right, that our legal system had grown up over so many centuries and been fine-tuned over the years, up until then at least, before Blair came along, the vast majority of our laws did actually make a great deal of sense, and that the way to understand any law was to ask yourself why it would need to be like that, and then if you looked at it logically, you would discover that it was like that. For instance, as I've been saying to people recently in relation to Ireland's trouble, and I got a letter in the Telegraph saying, as Ireland's only hope is to devalue to a level at which it is again competitive and write off its debts and start again, why is Britain spending £3 or 4 billion trying to prevent them doing so? So have you ever wondered why we have a bankruptcy law that allows people to write off their debts?
It is a recognition that
somebody is so deep in the mire that they can never recover if they continue as they are. And in the name of humanity, you cannot any longer throw people into debtor's prison for the rest of their lives or condemn them for the rest of their lives to work to try to make money simply to pay somebody else, because the blunt truth is that they won't do it. So the law rightly recognized that at some point of indebtedness, you have to say enough is enough. Write it all off. The people who have lost money or lent money knew when they lent it that they were taking a risk. The risk has now become real. They've lost it. They've got to recognize that and allow people to climb out of the pit and start again, which is exactly the position that Ireland is in and Greece are in.
Would you agree with Idris there, Martin, on this point about Ireland, particularly the idea that Britain really shouldn't be bailing out Ireland because it's just sort of almost digging them deeper in the pit?
Yeah, and it's not 3.5 billion, it's 7.5 billion that's been put aside. Supposedly, the deal is that they get this money provided they deflate their economy and agree to pay the debt back. But as I said earlier, there's going to be a general election in March in the Irish Republic. And it's very likely that a government will come to power which will repudiate the debt, because they haven't really got any option. I mean, he's right about that. They haven't really got any option. They have to repudiate the debt. But I think in the southeast of England, where he sounds like he comes from...
Well, he's in Hampshire, actually.
Hampshire. I don't think he realises what the consequences of that will be, because that means that the City of London, the RBS, Lloyds, will take the hit, and then the Conservative Chancellor of the Exchequer, George Osborne, will have to decide whether to bail out the British banks, just... to because of the Irish refusing to pay. Of course, it's not just the Irish that are going to refuse to pay. They're just going to be the first to refuse to pay. And then we'll basically we'll, the Conservative Liberal coalition will face the, are they prepared to bail the banks out or should they let them collapse? And we're having all this talk about what cuts are going to be and this, that and the other, but events are likely to be much more traumatic than that. And in that sense, I think Eurosceptics like your gentleman are correct in what they're suggesting, but they haven't thought it through. Because what that actually means is that the City of London will be bankrupted. I'm in favour of that, but of course I don't suppose he is.
Well, I think what Idris Francis is really saying there is that he thinks actually that the European Central Bank and the Brussels are actually creating the climate where Britain is helping bail out Ireland, put them deeper into debt. Actually,
we're bailing out our own banks. Yeah, this has been presented and spun as we are helping the Irish. George Osborne has put 7.5 billion aside to bail out RBS and Lloyds, not Ireland. It's presented as it's we're giving money to the Irish, so you've got the right wing of the Conservative Party, why are we giving money to the Irish? We're not giving money to the Irish, we're giving money to our own banks. It's another bailout of the banks by the back door. But I suspect that the new government that will come to power in Ireland will repudiate the debt because they haven't got any choice, and then the British banks will take the hit, and then the Conservative Liberal coalition will have to decide what they're going to do about the British banks. And that's before Portugal, Spain, Greece, and Argentina, you know, Thailand refuse to pay, because that's how it's going to be.
Why is it then, do you think, that the Conservative Party is the only one that seems to have a really strong Eurosceptic wing?
No, I mean, to be honest with you, there's been a strong Eurosceptic strain within the Labour Party. Gordon Brown, for example, did not take Britain into the Euro, despite what Tony Blair wanted to do. That, with hindsight, appears to be quite a sensible decision. But let me just say about what the purpose of the European Union and the Euro is. I used to work in Eastern Europe. The purpose of the European Union, as originally conceived by the French civil service and their German counterparts, was to create, make war in Europe unthinkable, because there was such a lot of interdependence between countries that they wouldn't go to war with each other ever again. So that there's a kind of war prevention aspect to the EU, which people have forgotten. The other thing, of course, is to try and create a counterweight to the dollar and the domination of the international economy by Wall Street. Now, what's actually happened in the way the EU has been constructed is that the Americans have intervened at every level to make sure that the EU is compatible with their domination of the entire system. But the original conception of the French civil service was that we will create some kind of counterweight to American financial power.
Anyway, you may have heard Idris there say that he thinks the EU is totalitarian. So I asked him about whether he thinks the EU is actually democratic at all.
I've spent literally thousands of hours and thousands of pounds and been to hundreds of political meetings and spoken at nearly every one of them, finding out everything there is to know about the EU and its works. So I know what it is. It is totalitarian. It is evil. It is not just undemocratic, it is anti-democratic. Its entire ethos is, the same as it used to be in Russia, that the men in the office blocks at the in Brussels or in Russia can determine how the world should work in every minute detail and issue rules and laws that will tell everybody else in their country how to work, what to do, what hours to work, and that, in effect, that the official knows best, the people know nothing, and it is the only task of the people is to do as they're told. Well, I don't live my life like that. Will you name one of your MEPs? How much power have the MEPs got? None. Do you know how many laws the MEPs themselves can instigate? None. The only power to put forward laws belongs to...
It's the Commission.
Who elected the Commission? Chris Patton was appointed by Major. Leon Britton was appointed by Maggie to get him out of the country. Neil Kinnock was appointed to the Commission by Tony Blair because he had failed as a prospective Prime Minister. He has a huge pension on which he pays 11% income tax. There is nothing whatever democratic about the European Union. The European Parliament is a facade of democracy. I have many UKIP and a few Conservative MEPs who are personal friends of mine, and they all say the same. the people who are there refer to it as the bubble. It is a bubble of extravagance, of high living at taxpayers' expense, with no democratic provenance whatever. It is a shambles, it is a fraud, it is the very antithesis of democracy. I'm a Democrat. I believe in one man, one vote, by which politicians who control policy and the country are elected by the voters and can be removed by the voters. You only have to go and look at the fundamental principles of democracy which started in this country, or to an extent may have started in Greece or Rome 2,000 years ago, but in modern terms started in this country in the last 300 years, to see that the EU is not any form of democracy. It is an organization run by greedy, grasping, terminally corrupt, power-mad, ego-driven, and terminally incompetent people who are unelected by the population at large, appoint one another to whatever positions they like, and who, amongst other things, have thousands of secret bank accounts around the world containing billions of euros, of which there is no official record.
Well, it's one thing saying that they're bumbling and corrupt, but it's another thing entirely to say that this is some kind of Nazi-type organisation.
I know a lot of people in the anti-EU fight, and I have a circulation list of several hundred people. I doubt if there's any one of them who does not agree that the main driving force behind the European Union always was and remains Germany, with France, whose view apparently of Germany has always been that Germany is the cart horse of this operation, whilst the French is the jockey who rides on its back telling it what to do. But of course that's the French ego. Chancellor Kohl had to stand down as Chancellor because he was forced to admit that he was regularly accepting thousands, many say that the figure, total figure was millions of euros, in used banknotes in suitcases in dark car parks to fund his politics. He was in total control of his party because he had unlimited amounts of slush funds to retain his grip on power. And you know what he said when he admitted it and stood down? That it doesn't really matter because it was all in a good cause. The good cause being his control of the party and his determination to ram the European Union down the throats of people who didn't want it. As a friend of mine says, the words, the ends justify the means, are amongst the most evil words in the whole English language. Because if you believe them, if you accept them, it allows you to do anything, however dishonest, however devious, because you think that the objective that you are trying to achieve is a good one. And I've said, funny enough, I had a discussion with quite a lot of people relatively recently on email, and by and large they agreed that in all probability Adolf Hitler never saw himself as evil or perverted. He probably did, in his own head, think himself as a man who was doing what was necessary to achieve desirable goals of success and domination for Germany. And of course there are some people talking about the Yorkshire Ripper and people like that. How can we understand what goes in the head of people who are mad? But when we fundamentally come down to it, what we have with the European Union is an entirely corrupt organization, which was incidentally set up to be corrupt.
So, I mean, he's coming out with all sorts of stuff there, Martin. I mean, what about this connection with Germany? I mean, as you said yourself, Germany does seem to be in the driving seat in Europe.
Well, no, it was quite right to say that the French see themselves as the jockeys of the German cartels. The Germans could have managed quite happily without the European Union. The French insisted on the European Union, the Monnet plan and so on, to make sure that Germany couldn't just go its own way, because basically France had fought two wars with Germany in the 20th century and they didn't want to fight another one. I mean, there's a whole historical perspective which is missing from that gentleman's analysis. Britain can't avoid the fact that major, you know, peace in Europe is in our interests, and some form of EU was virtually inevitable. And don't forget that General de Gaulle didn't want Britain in the EU because he knew that people like him would get inside the fence and mess up what the French were trying to do. And when Edward Heath tried to join the EU, General de Gaulle famously said non, twice.
What about his accusation there about the European Commission, which is where all the new policy comes from, has got all these people who are basically failed politicians like Chris Patten and Neil Kinnock?
The problem with the European Commission is that what happens is the politicians appoint the people that go. You know, basically, national governments, whether it's in Germany, France, Britain or Ireland, do not want their decisions to be taken in Brussels. So on that basis, we don't actually have a European political election. Yeah, we don't have a once every 4 years we're going to elect the government of Europe, because there's far too much variation. People just don't identify with Europe. So because people want to keep decision making at the local level, the commission has to be appointed by national governments rather than directly elected. I mean, the gentleman should wonder what he wishes for. Does he want a directly elected commission? Because then they really would have the power. At the moment, they've got limited power because most of the power is still at the level of national governments. There is a democratic deficit in the EU. The European Central Bank is independent of the politicians because that's what the markets wanted. Now, he's got to remember that there are other evil forces out there in the world. They're called Wall Street and the Pentagon, and somebody's got to stand up to them. Who's going to be that? And he's a member of UKIP, the United Kingdom Independence Party. That sounds like a good name for a party, unless you live in South Wales, South Scotland, or Northern Ireland, because, of course, many people in those parts of the world see Westminster as a problem. Far more of a problem than Brussels. And Brussels, in fact, employs less people, as bureaucrats are employed in Brussels, than are employed by Bristol City Council. There's an awful lot of huffing and puffing there, and an awful lot of Middle England talking to itself.
What about...
You're not speaking to people from Scotland, are you?
What about...
They've got a very different view of the EU.
I mean, one of the things you've said is that the EU is very important to counterbalance the US.
In principle.
But one of the things he pointed out to me was that the European accounts have not been audited, rather like the Federal Reserve's accounts haven't been audited.
Well, there is a democratic deficit in the EU. Both the EU... The United States and Britain are run by a financial oligarchy, and that's what goes on behind this. A warmongering financial oligarchy. The EU actually hasn't got its own army, so the warmongering is relatively limited. But of course, everything is run by the wealthy behind the scenes, and the various mechanisms that we have are simply inadequate to keep these people under control, whether it's in Britain, the EU or the United States.
Anyway, our final clip from Idris Francis from UKIP is about his uncle and the Nazis.
My uncle, whom I knew well until he died sadly young in 1960 at the age of 46, but I knew him from the early 50s when he used to come down to stay with us in Cardiganshire. Very brilliant character who, amongst other things, knew David Niven and Eric Mashevitz, the musician. He went across on D-Day on a landing craft as a regimental sergeant major with a pistol in his hand to make sure that everybody got off the landing craft. Fortunately, didn't have to use it. But in terms of what actually happened at Nuremberg, well, he was a major in the Royal Artillery, and he was stationed in Hamburg.
What exactly did these German generals say, then?
Well, the words, as I remember them, and as my aunt told me some years ago now, was, yes, you have beaten us again for the second time, but next time we will win. And those words so far could mean anything, but the really significant part was, but next time, it'll all happen so slowly, you won't realize that it's happening until it's all over. Which to me means that they knew of the German plan for what became the European Union. The third time, they would do it by stealth and by deceit instead of by force of arms.
So why is it that you link this directly then to the EU?
Other people who are on my circulation list translated some years ago a German plan from about 1942 or 1943, setting out how Germany would run Europe after they had won the war. It was written, of course, at a time when they still thought that they would win the war. And the parallels between that and the European Union are almost exact. I have actually seen a photocopy. This was 10 or 15 years ago. I saw a photocopy of that German planning document, which was produced at some meeting of the high command in about 1942. And it includes, for instance, not a single currency as such, because it says, apparently, you couldn't expect the British, for example, to give up their pounds, but it would just be locked permanently in value against the German mark. And the division of the country, of Europe, into effectively what some people are now calling economic protectorates in relation to Ireland was much the same. And the whole ethos of the whole plan was clearly what the European Union now is.
Well, Martin, that's Idris Francis, the final clip from him, convinced that the plan for the EU was drawn up by the Nazis in the Second World War.
Well, I'm afraid it's just over-egged. There are definite criticisms that can be made about the EU. There's many failings, lots of things wrong with it, but every single East European country I used to work in were all mad keen to get inside the EU because they saw it as the club of modernity. And of course the EU does enforce human rights standards and all the rest of it. And to compare the EU to Nazi Germany, I think is just overblown, way overblown.
Okay, well, that was Martin Summers and Idris Francis talking about... Idris Francis is from UKIP, he's a UKIP supporter, former Conservative and passionate Eurosceptic. Now, next week, one of Ian R. Crane, someone called Ian R. Crane, will be in town, and he'll be speaking in Bristol. At one of Ian's talks, you will be gobsmacked to hear about literally scores of topics that you will almost certainly not read about in the Bristol Evening Post or the national newspapers or hear about on the BBC. Hi, Ian, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, Tony. Hi, Martin. Thanks for the invitation.
Now, can you tell us whereabouts you're going to be speaking next week and what you'll be talking about?
Sure, I'm going to be speaking at the Hungerford Community Centre, which is on Hungerford Road, which is Brislington. Those code is Bristol BS45EX. And the title of the talk is Surviving the Final Meltdown. And then the subtitle is Financial Terrorism Exposed. And I'm speaking to you right now, actually, from the country that is still on point here in terms of the financial terrorism. I gave a talk yesterday, and perhaps I just caught the tail end of the previous guest on your show, and the title of my talk yesterday was Occupation by Stealth. Because in reality, of course, Ireland actually no longer exists. And I made the observation in my talk that, you know, this is the first time today that I'd actually had the opportunity to speak in a full-blown EU colony, because the Irish government is a complete disarray at the moment. You know, the resignations from the Irish cabinet have been occurring at a phenomenal rate, so much so that Brian Cowan has been forced to call an election. Interestingly, on a date that will resonate with you, Tony, on March the 11th, 3/11. Remember what happened 7 years ago on 3/11. Basically, I mean, what we're talking about is in Bristol is looking at the lessons perhaps from Ireland, looking at the lessons that the EU has certainly learned from Ireland, because it seems that instead of rushing in to effectively convert ostensibly a private debt, i.e. the bondholders, and convert it to public debt through the bank bailouts, it would seem that certain players in the EU have actually recognised they might not get away with that again. But the reality is that we are on the brink of a financial meltdown, And anybody who, you know, wishes to bury their heads in the sand, well, good luck to them. So what I'm going to be talking about, employees, I'm going to be explaining how this is a contrived financial meltdown. I should be producing the evidence which shows that, you know, many, many commentators have been trying to warn people that it was coming. I myself gave a presentation in 2006, another one I recorded in 2007, stated on the brink of the collapse, and 1 month after I recorded the second of those presentations, Northern Rock collapsed. But we won't spend too much time looking perhaps at the historical aspects of it. You know, what I'm more interested in is sharing with people, you know, my research and, you know, my insights as to, you know, maybe steps that people can take to actually avoid getting caught up in the worst of what's potentially just a few months away.
Hi, it's Martin here, Ian. I tend to agree with you that we're on the verge of a collapse. We have sort of regular politicians on this show every week from all the parties, and they're all basically in denial about the seriousness of the situation, as you know.
Yeah.
They tend to say, well, things are going to carry on as they are, aren't they? And of course, as you well know, the answer is no. I would see the general election in Ireland as being crucial, because I suspect that the Labour Party and Sinn Féin are going to do very well, and they should, if necessary, leave the euro. They should certainly repudiate their debt, and maybe leave the EU altogether, possibly. And these are the kind of things that weren't being talked about even 6 months ago, but they're now absolutely realistic politics. But of course, what that will mean is a crash. The British banks are exposed to $200 billion of Irish debt. And as you say, the bondholders should take the hit. But the Bilderberg Group and all of these people behind the scenes are trying to pass the buck onto the ordinary people for the crisis in the financial sector. But the Irish have got a history of belligerent self-assertion. If you think back to the 1916 uprising or whatever, and I look forward to them doing the business in the new year.
One thing I can't resist asking you about is if you have a take on all the stories we've been hearing about birds dropping out of the sky.
Well, I'm keeping an open mind. I mean, I'm, you know, well aware of all the these that have been put forward. But at the moment, I must confess, I don't have a definitive view on what's occurring here. It's certainly one to watch, because, of course, it's not just the birds. It's, you know, we've got the problem with marine life as well. You know, in the Gulf of Mexico, it's very easy to identify the cause of that, and that is, of course, the oil spill. But elsewhere in the world, where we have massive schools of fish being washed up on the shores, it's obviously not related to the Gulf of Mexico. So there's definitely something going wrong. But Tony, can I just go back to the financial side for a second? Because I've got to acknowledge that for one of the first times I can ever recollect, I'm in pretty much agreement with everything Martin just said.
Finally, we're going to have to wind it up now, Ian. And could you just tell us, remind us again where and when you're going to be speaking in Bristol?
Yep, it's next Tuesday evening, so that's Tuesday the 25th. It's a 7 p.m. start, and the title of the talk again is Surviving the Final Meltdown, Financial Terrorism Exposed. And like I said, you know, the primary objective is to give people the opportunity to have a little bit of an insight and encourage them to do their own research and follow on exactly from you know, what Martin has just been discussing, and then to, you know, look at some practical steps that people can take to avoid getting caught up in the worst of the coming mire.
Okay, and where can we find you on the internet, Ian?
Ian R. Crane, that's IANRCRANE, ianrcrane.co.uk. People can book advance tickets on the web there.
Okay, that's all we've got time for. I'm sorry, I'm going to have to fade you out there, Ian, because it's the end for tonight. That's all for this week. Coming up, the Sky News at 7 o'clock. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, Lib Dem Cabinet Member for Health and Inequalities, Ashley Ward Councillor John Rogers, and to Mike Birkin from South West Friends of the Earth. See you next week.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol